your consultancy, Mr. Love, did you find at all levels cooperation and rapport with what you were trying to do with the design?
Well, absolutely, because you see, the people that I dealt with were the top people, the president and the chief engineer, etc. So that there had to be cooperation pretty well.
So they welcomed your
they did. And they, of course, would carry out sometimes in their own way many of the suggestions, and some of them, you never completely get exactly what you want.
Right. In
any phase, in any business.
Mm-hmm.
This is an experience that all designers have had in Ford or Chrysler or anywhere. Mm-hmm. But and the main thing is that the themes themselves were carried out,
mm-hmm.
and that's the important thing. Sometimes details didn't turn out exactly the way you wanted, either because of cost or production,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a divergence of opinion.
Can you tell us some of the details that you, the major changes you made that resulted in the DSM?
Well, the whole concept, the front end is a completely new departure,
mm-hmm.
whereby all the lights and the grill are eliminated. The grill first was eliminated, but all the lights and the license plate was covered by a curved shatterproof glass that made it quite aerodynamic.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, it had one of the lowest CXs of any car at the time.
You know what that was?
I think it was 0.23. And of course, the other thing was that it was a two-door sport touring car that had a deluxe leather interior. All the instrument panel was brand new type of steering wheel, shift lever, all sorts of innovations. Besides which, the performance itself was extraordinary. It had progressive power steering. The steering wheels themselves would return to normal when you got out of the car.
Mm-hmm.
It had non-locking braking, and of course the suspension was from the old Dayes, the self-leveling suspension.
The
same level no matter what the load.
Right.
But you could change the height of the car depending on conditions of the roads or snow or ice.
So you changed it from an ugly duckling to a really beautiful car.
Yes, I'll show you some of the pictures I have where it was named the car of the year,
mm-hmm.
and what the competition was.
Yeah. What were the differences in working, say, with an American company and a foreign company? Difficulties less in terms of personality clashes? You were obviously, as a consultant, you were kept away from most of the divergences of opinion and this.
Well, actually, the where there were any difficulties, it was merely in difficulty of accomplishment, you see, because they don't have the facilities or the ability that large corporations have here to build models or to put into effect different elements of design that we have. Their equipment is not as good, or maybe now it is,
yeah.
but at that time it wasn't.
How about their fabrication department? Did they have?
Well, they could do anything, but they didn't do it as quickly or as well, or some things they couldn't do.
Did you work with models?
I would bring over, to begin with, small-scale models.
Would you?
Yes.
You do in your shop?
Yes.
And they would try to duplicate those?
Well, or change them. You know, they would be discussed.
What scale would that be?
Well, some of them, one-tenth.
One-tenth. Were you working on the entire line, or were you working simply on the sports car?
Well, what I really would do was to take an element that I thought needed design. The strange thing was I never could attack the deux chevaux. That's the 2-horsepower one. You know, that ugly thing that looks like a beer can.
Was that a sacred cow or what?
Well, in a way it was. You see, this was the one that caused Hitler to build a Volkswagen.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it looks somewhat like it, only it's corrugated.
Oh, corrugated.
The thing is that now they have changed it. Finally, that's the new AX that I just mentioned a moment ago.
Is the final transformation of the deux chevaux.
Yes. But, you see, that was, after the war, a cheap means of transportation that the French public, a farmer, this car, you could take the back seat out, you could put a giraffe in the back of your mother-in-law or whatever. And it would go forever.
Sort of the Model T of...
It was ugly, it was a horrible thing to drive, but it worked.
Mm-hmm. And it was cheap.
And it was cheap, yes. So just until last year or the year before, they sold that same car forever. Like the Volkswagen sold for a long time.
Right.
So
that,
that was the one, of course, that I wanted to change the most.
But you found some resistance there.
Yes.
But the rest of the line, you were able to influence by subtle differences.
Yes, the GS, you see, is the next, in between that was the MECs, which was just a higher grade deux chevaux. That was an ugly one, too.
Is it AMI-6?
Yeah, AMI means friend.
Mm-hmm.
AMI, yes.
SIX, yeah.
Well, the numeral 6.
Oh, the numeral 6, okay, good.
And
then the
next one up became the GS. That was the first one that I worked on.
And GS stands in automobile nomenclature for?
I don't believe it has any.
It's not Grand Sport or anything?
No, it's far from that.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, good.
It's a plain back 4-passenger car that sold very well, and it was named the car of the year in Europe. And then came the SM, which came out in 72, which was a grand touring sport coupe, really. And then came the CX, which was sort of a standard sedan, I would say, that replaced the DS. The CX meaning, the coefficient of aerodynamics.
The what? Oh, of course.
Yes.
So you...
And that got the car of the year award, too.
So all of these were your creations in terms of styling.
Yes.
And interior design. Did you find this dumpster make exciting work?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Given roughly a free hand and seeing your creations come to life like that.
That's true, yes.
Did you spend quite a few years in France over a period of time working?
Well, I'd go over there 2-3 times a year, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
For different lengths of time.
Yeah. Would you stay mostly in Paris?
Mostly, yes. Oh, I'd stay in Paris all the time I was working with them, yes.
Yeah. Where were
that was the nice thing about it, that it was their plants right on the Seine River.
Oh, I see.
Just down the river from the Eiffel Tower. And then, however, they have a new styling building, which is out at Vélizy, which is a V-E-L-I-Z-Y.
Mm-hmm.
V-E-L-E-Z-Y.
Is that a suburb there?
Yes, it's on the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. Was that partly your inspiration, that they should have a separate design studio?
Well, I believe so, yes. Because up until then, their quarters were really cramped and
industrial.
Yes. The plant on the Seine River was actually an old plant as well. Very, very spacious, of course. It's about a square mile.
What sort of commissions did you have, American and other international commissions, while you were working for Citroën? Did you maintain a staff here in
Well, I would Michigan? Actually, no, I had a very small staff. I would mainly farm out work.
Would you?
Yes. I came to the conclusion that, before I started, that it'd be better to keep my hand on the design itself. In other words, the actual design and the final look. But, you know, as far as having a wood shop or a metal shop or whatever, just farm it out.
Uh-huh.
I'd have the models made by other people.
There were then, as there are now, quite a few support industries
here
in the area,
yes,
for fabrication and
that's correct.
Prototype.
And so I've been doing the same thing with the electric car.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, here in Detroit, there are great supply like Creative Industries and Car Craft and Car and Concepts and ASC and so forth.
And you're able to farm out the actual fabrication.
Yes. And so we've built 12 prototypes of the Silver Volt.
Tell us how that was conceived. What was the inspiration for it?
My partner in this is Mr. Aronson, who invented the battery. The main thing is the battery, of course.
Aronson.
Robert Aronson. And he's been working on the batteries all his life.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a plant in New Orleans, and the hurricane knocked it out. And so, in the meantime, he invented this battery, which he decided was a great battery for automotive use.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up here to Detroit and built a few electric cars, which one of them won the Cross America race.
Mm-hmm.
But when I met him, he was attempting to get into a car that, you know, to sell to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how this started.
It's unusual in the age of the ubiquitous combustion engine to have some visionary come along to think that he could recreate the electric car.
Of course, when I went with him, that was at the time of the oil crunch.
Ah. Yeah, okay, so.
And people were steamed about that,
yes,
as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
After we developed it, I got a phone call from a woman in California. She says, I'll buy four of them if I can get them, because I got four factories and I can't even get gas enough to get there. And
so
I got a call from the mayor of Juneau, Alaska. He said, how would you like to be supply all the cars for our city?
Mm-hmm.
I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, he says, our city is not connected by rail or road to other cities. You have to come by boat.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, what about the climate? You know, we had tested the car in Alaska, but he said, well, we're on the Japanese current. We have the best climate in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, you got hills that get iced up. He says, yeah, but you don't have to worry about that, because if no car can get up.
So there was a real need.
Oh, yes. And I think there still is. You see, right now, there are cities like Tokyo, L.A., Seoul, Denver, Mexico City that are smoggy. They're terrible.
Yes.
And they're dangerous.
And most of them for the internal combustion engine.
Yes, that's
true.
Even now.
Yeah.
And what we plan on doing is marketing the car in L.A. to begin with. And we had 24... See, we have the only battery in the world you can charge in 45 minutes. Everybody else takes 8 hours.
Wonderful.
And we have 24 fast charge stations in L.A. now. And we are going to build a prototype, the next one. The one that we built was based on a car that's out of production.
Mm-hmm.
We used Fisher Body for that one. This one will be based on a different one. And we have a member of that outfit that is going to invest in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, manufacturing facilities are available to you, and you have the...
We'll develop the prototype here the way we did the last one.
Mm-hmm.
With one of these prototype builders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who build cars actually for Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors.
They're happy to.
Oh, yes.
Take on the...
That's right. I'll show you a picture of that car in a minute.
If you can describe it to our listening audience in audio visual terms, if you can.
Well,
what it is.
This is a luxury sedan that is very aerodynamic, with a choice of velour leather interior, with all of the amenities of a luxury car, power seats and windows and brakes and steering and air conditioning. And it will sell for roughly $20,000, $19,000 to be exact.
What kind of a market are you going after?
Well, we're going after, first of all, a market in LA for people who, I think my idea is to sell it to begin with through a rent-a-car company who can claim to be clearing up the smog in LA, for instance. Now, doing it that way, you see, is a company that has already the elements that you need. It has a parts department, has a service department, and you have national advertising. And not only that, but they can start with a small number of cars, which you would have to do anyway. And in that way, you have a ready-made market, and then you build it up from there. Now, we're talking not only about passenger car, we're also talking about electric vans. There's an association of power companies in the United States, about 1,000 power companies, who are interested in electric vans. And as a matter of fact, I think Ford is developing one now. So is GM. So is Eaton. And I think we can beat them all.
Really? What
I mean, performance-wise and price-wise.
Without giving away any proprietary information, how do you propose to accomplish that?
Without giving away any information, it's impossible to say.
Of course, this will be heard probably a year from now, maybe about time to get it out. So
well,
just in general terms.
In general terms, our propulsion system will perform better than any that I know of because of the battery and because of patented elements that we have. We have a battery that is, we have a patented automatic watering system, venting system, and cooling system, and heating system. You see, batteries don't perform well in cold weather, so this is automatically heated as well. Besides which, we are familiar with the performance of the car, which would be roughly the same as the van, except we would have more battery. And
is there a problem with storing the batteries in the vehicle itself, or where are you going to put them? Where the engine is, or
we separate them. We put half in the front and half in the rear to balance the weight.
Good.
Batteries are heavy.
Did Mr. Aronson come up with a special kind of different kind of battery for this concept?
Well, he invented this battery without thinking of cars to begin with, and then decided, well, the fast charge ability is the only thing that makes an electric car feasible.
I see.
You see, for instance, we've been from here to Chicago with one stop in Kalamazoo for a fast charge while you eat lunch. Now, if it was a regular, you wouldn't want to sit there for 8 hours. You couldn't. That's a long lunch.
Yes,
right. So that plus the fact then most people, when they think of electric cars, think of, suppose I get stuck on the expressway. Well, most electric cars can't go on the expressway. Some of them can't even get up the ramp.
You mean the ones that are in
regular electric cars that I know of,
yeah, right.
They don't have any performance.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, you see, we have researched the whole thing, and GM and Ford and Chrysler, we're all trying to make a small electric car. Well, you can't get enough battery in it for performance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too lightweight.
Mm-hmm.
So that we have, we believe, overcome.
You mentioned propulsive units. Are you able to say anything more about that?
Propulsion system. Well, it's the controller and the regulators and the motor is a special built motor, and all of those elements go together to make a reliable system. And the thing about people when they talk about electric cars, as I say, they're afraid of getting stuck on the expressway. We have a small rotary engine that is a supplementary engine, so that if you see, we have a instrument that tells the condition of the battery, which is also a battery.
Yes.
And when that happens, if you see your battery's getting low, you can push a button and turn on this rotary engine, give you another 100 miles.
Oh, marvelous.
So that you never get stuck anywhere.
I suppose the big sticking point is the location and the number of charging stations in terms of expansion.
Yes. You can actually charge it anywhere, but then you take long.
Yeah, right.
The fast charge station is a patented item, and it's meant to be, for instance, that's the reason we put 24 in L.A., because then no matter where you are, you can have your nearest station.
Mm-hmm.
And then at night, you can go home and plug it in your own house and charge it overnight.
On the normal
procedure, yes.
Yeah, right. Did Mr. Hansel come up with this fast charging principle, or...?
Yes. Yes.
Around,
no. That's his too.
That's his too.
Yes.
What about the exterior of the car? What type of configuration do you have in mind?
Well, to begin with, we're talking about a 4-door sedan, 6-passenger.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll show you a picture of it if you want.
But I'm.
Oh, you're recording.
This.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I'm getting a little hoarse. I think I'll have a glass of water.
Oh, fine. Mr. Love, harking back to your background and your career at General Motors, especially the days when you were working on the full interior line, did you feel that you had brought to the General Motors line a sort of a flair and a spaciousness and an ambiance that they, in terms of innovations in color and fabrics, feeling for spaciousness that they didn't have before?
Well, I think I did because of the fact that in Paris I had been doing fashion design,
mm-hmm.
and my knowledge of fabrics and different colors and fashions, of course, affected my judgment about design, automotive interior design, naturally, because, and that gave me an ability to vary, for instance, Motorama cars. We did one that was called the Debutante, that was all trimmed in mink and moire silk.
Mm-hmm.
Others, of course, with different kinds of fabrics and furs, even, that were as exotic as could be and astounded quite a few people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And even our own.
So you really pushed them in a sense to
yes,
come up with something quite different.
We even did a Buick coupe, I recall, which didn't have anything to do with fabrics, but we chrome plated the whole instrument panel and did it all in silver leather.
Mm.
It was pretty glary.
Was it a bit glary, yeah.
But of course, I mean, not practical for use, but I mean it was spectacular as a show car.
Mm-hmm.
And then we did special cars for different people, as I said.
Yes, some of the some famous people you designed for.
Yes, and we did special cars for the Canadian GM of Canada also, that were shown at the Toronto annual World's Fair show,
mm-hmm.
Canadian Fair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Canadian Exposition.
Exposition, that's
right.
It. Their headquarters, of course, were in Oshawa, which was about 20 miles out of Toronto.
Mm-hmm. So, in spite of your differences with certain strong personalities, you enjoyed your and did some of your best work at General Motors.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
And I think I contributed a lot, too,
mm-hmm. Yes, you did.
Because the thing is that, for instance, there's a designer there that one seems not to mention, but I considered one of the very best, and that was Art Ross.
You
may have heard
of
him. He was head of the Oldsmobile studio,
mm-hmm.
and
I've heard of it.
Before that, worked in the Cadillac studio with Mitchell,
mm-hmm.
and was you know, an innovator there.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he was a very good artist as well.
Mm-hmm.
I considered him one of the best in GM,
mm-hmm.
and he left shortly after I did.
He was not as recognized as he should have been.
I think so, yes.
How about Mr. Ned Nichols, you spoke of earlier?
Ned Nichols, I thought of very highly, and as I say, I recommended him for the Buick chief designer, which he was for quite a while.
What were his strengths?
Well, he had an inquiring mind and did a large variety of renderings, you know, of all different types. He wouldn't stick to one theme, so that it gave people and himself as well, an ability to choose the best among many. And he was a good renderer too.
And he succeeded you in the Buick Design Post when you left GM.
Well, no, when I was promoted.
Oh, that was promoted to the administrative post.
That's right. That's right.
Anybody else that sticks out in your mind as a key person over that era?
Yeah, turnout officer.
You mentioned a designer that you particularly remember from.
Yes, another one of the very best ones is Jack Humbert, who
H-U-M-B-E-R-T,
who was with me to begin with in the interior studios, and then later in the Pontiac studio, and then he was later promoted to an executive design job. But unfortunately, he became ill and died a short time ago.
But he was an essential promise.
Yes, he was a fantastic renderer too.
Was he?
Yeah, one of the best.
Do you did you have any experience with the Opel operation?
No, that of course was a German operation, and Henry Hager was over there for quite a while. He was a good designer too.
He
still is with them, and one of the very best too.
That's good. You mentioned that you probably had worked with Charles Jordan.
Oh yes, Charles Jordan was there in a special studio when I was still there.
Was he?
Yes, he came from California.
An advanced studio, was it? Or?
I believe so, yes.
And Mr. David Holes, do you remember working with
Dave
him?
Dave Holes,
the
yes.
The young designer at that time?
Yes, he's still there too.
And he had several particular strengths as well.
Yes, I believe he was in Europe as well for a while.
He did tour it open.
Yes.
Mr. Irvin Rybicki, did you work with him?
Irvin Rybicki, not particularly. He was in the Cadillac studio with Bill Mitchell at the time, I believe.
Did you think, without asking you to be provocative, but did you think that Mr. Earl retired early, or was he pretty much
No, he was at the retirement age.
Yes. It was a mandatory thing, 65.
That's right. Which, in some cases, I believe is not good, because some people are at their peak at that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you have your health, you know, why not? You still got your brain.
Yeah.
And all of that experience, and if you can grow with it, why, that's the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if you're incapacitated, that's something else again.
It seems rather arbitrary rule, I think.
They're changing it now.
Are they?
Yes, I understand that it has been changed.
At General Motors?
Well, even at the government.
Yeah, the government loves it. The train at General Motors after you left, were you happy with what it what transpired?
Well, I was happy to see that gaudy period disappear, which it finally did, and then actually after it did, there was a very good period of design, I thought. You know, much cleaner and sleeker and so forth. I've always considered cars to be, you know, have personalities, that cars should have certain attributes that should not be overlooked or missing. Cars should have refinement, of course quality goes with it. But I mean a certain amount of jewelry and a certain amount of sleekness and a little fierceness. In other words, a car should inspire people. The thing is, if you want to have a reaction, a positive reaction about cars, you will get it immediately from children and from black people. If they say, wow, you've got it made. And this is, you know, almost universal. It's a young at heart type of thing. And people who love cars have to be young at heart. And I say at heart, but it's the mind itself that goes with it. That makes it feel that way. And the thing is, you know, whether a car is angular whether it's rounded, whether it's sleek, or whether it's aerodynamic. Even if it's a truck, it has to have appeal.
Mm-hmm. And there has been attempts in recent years to come up with a well-designed truck as well.
Oh, vans are big now. Vans and station wagons and pickup trucks, sure.
Half the market sometimes.
That's right. Or even, you know, huge ones. So, Mack, I'm sorry to see them go.
Yes, yes. You had no qualms when you left General Motors. You felt you could find your way in the world of industrial design without any trouble.
Oh, I knew it, yes. The thing is, when you're an automobile designer, you can pretty well design anything. Automobile automobiles involve so many different phases of design. Plastics, textiles, leather, jewelry, metals. It involves economics. It involves logic, of course. And it involves public research. The mind of the public is the most important thing. You have to think ahead. The unfortunate thing about some companies, they rely on what they call customer research. They ask customers what they want for the future. Well, they don't know. All they know is the past. And it's the designer that has to dream of the future, and it becomes his profession to do so.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Futurama himself.
Exactly. Yeah, he has to. Do you get the impression that, following up on that, do you get the impression that there's been an increased, almost insane reliance on what they call customer research, that they're allowing the uninformed public to dictate what they should
I do? Think that happens quite often, and I'm not sure how much they do rely on it now, but I do think, as a general remark, that designers today, I'm talking about in all of the different companies,
mm-hmm.
are possibly more alert to this and more knowledgeable than they were in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate thing is that you designers today have so many people looking over their shoulder and dictating.
Mm-hmm.
You have the government, you have engineers, you have cost accountants, and you have administration dictating sometimes what they should do.
Mm-hmm.
It would be much better if they were to allow them as much freedom as possible until you get down to the wire,
mm-hmm.
and the wire being, you know, the day that you release the car.
Mm-hmm. following that up, do you feel that there were compromises you had to make because of these various factors that you felt uncomfortable with?
Well, some compromises, of course, are necessary. If you design a taillight that costs twice as much as it should cost, you of necessity will have to redesign it and
mm-hmm.
trying to hold on to your design concept, and that goes for the whole car.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as general procedure, I would say that in the days of Holly Earle, particularly, that we had a sort of a clean slate.
Did you?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he would back you up, or you would back him up. We had periodic meetings with each division, and in the presentation of a car or in the final okay, there were very few rejections
mm-hmm.
and very few changes.
He was able to project the force of his personality. He was able to override some objections.
Yes. And of course, people involved would help him in that they would argue their points too, as far as design was concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Chief designers would be in on all of those meetings, and Harley Earle was always in the final meetings, but sometimes the chief designer would be alone in the meeting, and he had to stand up for his principles.
Mm-hmm. You remember any such instances that happened in your career at General Motors?
What happened?
You had to defend your design?
It was a constant thing.
Constant? Oh, how did that work?
Well, in other words, you would be asked why you did this, or shouldn't you change it to that, or many times it was just okayed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But on occasion you did have to explain it and defend it.
Mm-hmm. On the whole, your experience at General Motors was a good one.
Oh, it was a very pleasant one, yes.
You learned a lot, and you felt that you contributed a lot.
That's true. There were a lot of innovations and a lot of experiments,
mm-hmm.
a lot of progress.
Some of which worked, some of which didn't.
Sure.
What's your best feeling, or what is the work that you did at General Motors, what stands out as the one that gave you the most pleasure in terms of a realized model or a realized concept?
Oh, I don't think there is any one thing. I think it's just an aggregate of the complete whole. You see, there were so many different ones and so such a big succession, after all, 17 years.
Yeah.
And the number of cars involved, the number of projects, not just cars, that were intriguing. You know, the Train of Tomorrow, for instance, was a fabulous project in itself.
Tell us a bit about that.
Well, the train itself was a diesel locomotive that was a GM locomotive,
mm-hmm.
but the cars themselves were all new concepts in the layout of cars. They had passageways and double deckers and the serving of food and drinks and so forth, and the comfort of the passengers were solved in ways that were brand new.
Mm-hmm.
And the press and the public received it very well.
And you worked on much of this?
I worked, like I say, I contributed some, but mm-hmm. There were many people who did.
Mm-hmm. The concept of interiors, were you at this time in the 50s becoming more and more cognizant of the fact that you had to make it the interior comfortable and convenient for the passenger, something which...
Well, not only that, but safe.
And safe as well.
We had a safety studio as well.
Did you?
That was attempting to change items like control knobs and steering wheels and instrument panels and headlinings and rear view mirrors to make them safer for the passengers.
Mm-hmm.
And crash resistant.
This was probably the earliest attempt to really come up with a integrated inner compartment.
That's correct. And as a matter of fact, the Congress sent a group up here to investigate that, and we had a session with them telling them what we intended to do from a safety standpoint. And, of course, I don't have a recording of that meeting, but I wish I did.
Yes. They were obviously quite impressed, I suspect.
I suspect. Many of those things, however, never occurred.
Or they are occurring piecemeal over the years.
Yes, that's right.
A couple of decades.
But at that time, there was not the emphasis on safety that there is now.
I suppose that was that strange mentality that felt we mustn't remind the owner of safety considerations, it was scary.
Yes, because they thought perhaps that would make the customer feel that the car wasn't safe.
Yes. Uh-huh.
As opposed to the fact that you could have a nut run into you.
Are you pretty much in sympathy with what's being done today, the attempts at automatic seat belts and airbags?
Well, to a certain extent, I think there's too much emphasis on airbags. I think, as a matter of fact, the proper seatbelt arrangement could be safer than the airbag, and in particular, the automatic seatbelt, which several car companies have now, and I think it should be a standard for everybody, because then you wouldn't have to depend on an individual's forgetfulness or dislike.
Right.
He would just be obliged to wear it, and the automatic one actually is more comfortable and easier to apply. It may cost a little more, but I think it's a must.
So the GM experience and the Citroën experience, all of them very fruitful and contributed to your overall design philosophy, and now has culminated in this remarkable vehicle that you're currently working on. Can you give us sort of a case history of the whole project, how it started? You've told us something of meeting with Mr. Aronson and with his concept of a new concept of a modern battery. Can you tell us a little more in detail how the whole project came about and what are your plans for it?
Well, a very strange thing. I went to see an old friend of mine who was an automotive manufacturer's representative. And we were just talking about cars, and he said, you ought to go down and see this fellow, Aronson. He says, he's got a new kind of a battery and a new kind of an electric car that he's trying to develop, and I think you could help him out a lot, or he needs you. And so I did, and I became intrigued myself immensely. And so at that time, he wasn't particularly full of money, in other words.
He was
struggling, he was having a tough time.
Where was he located?
He was located over in the industrial center in Troy.
Oh, here in Troy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I said at the time that I would donate my services for stock
mm-hmm.
in the company, and we should form a new company and rename it.
Mm-hmm. What
and
is the company's name?
At that time, it was called Electric Fuel Propulsion Company,
mm-hmm.
which is a mouthful.
Yeah.
And I said, well, why don't we call it what it is? Electric Auto Corporation,
yeah, sure.
which is what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on...
He obviously was receptive to your original.
Yes. So... we built, at that time, a coupe that we showed. It was slight changes from a production coupe, but it was electrified.
Was this in the early 70s?
This was in about 77.
77. And by then, there was a perceived and felt need for this type of vehicle.
Especially due to the oil situation that was
right.
developing. And we showed it in various places, and in so doing, we raised some funds for research and development. And after that, we developed what we call the Silver Bolt. And that itself was a means of raising more. We built one prototype, and it was very well received. We also built an electric Cadillac limousine.
Did you?
Yes. And so
you modified an existing Cadillac limousine, or did you start from there?
Well, we started with the production one naturally, but electrified it
mm-hmm.
and changed the appearance.
Mm-hmm.
The Silver Bolt, of course, we started with a production Fisher body, but changed the front end and everything on it, interior, exterior. It was, as a matter of fact, a Buick Century station wagon.
Really?
And when we had finished changing it, we had driven a Buick dealer, and he didn't even know it was a Buick.
what were your early on in this company's history? What were your goals then, and do they square with what you're planning today?
Well, of course, we were planning on producing the car,
mm-hmm.
and which is a difficult thing to do, of course. And you have to raise the money to do it. Research money, we raised quite a bit, as you might imagine, to build 12 prototypes.
What sources?
From private investors.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yes, so we may have spent about $20 million developing the car. But then you come to a point of production, and that's the difficult part. And of course, at that time, too, the oil situation eased,
mm-hmm.
and the prices went down, and interest, of course, in the electric car receded,
mm-hmm.
so that we had to delay everything. And however, now there is some renewed interest, and the Arabs are talking about getting angry with us again. And the thing is that we have made big advances in the research and development of electrics so that they are much more feasible and practical and especially cost-wise because you relate one to the other in known terms, it amounts to getting 80 miles to the gallon,
mm-hmm.
cost-wise. And when you have an electric car, there are many items that you don't have to, I'm talking about service now,
mm-hmm.
You don't have to tune the engine, you know, and the carburetor, the exhaust, and all of that is eliminated. And an electric motor lasts practically forever.
Mm-hmm.
Right here, you know, I have a furnace in this house that was put in 1940,
mm-hmm.
and it's still running fine.
What innovations did you actually come up with in terms of beyond the electric principle? And I still want to ask you, the history of the electric automobile in this country has always been that it's marvelous. Yes, it's quiet, and it's certainly fuel conscious, but how are you going to keep those batteries running? Now, what innovations did Mr. Aronson come up with, and what concepts did you come up with to overcome that?
Well, you see, all of the elements that were difficult with an electric prior to now,
mm-hmm.
There were more electric cars in the United States at one time than there were gasoline cars.
Right. They threatened to run away with the market at one time.
Yes. But you see, those elements have now been overcome to a great extent.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that we have a battery now that you can charge. The reason you can fast charge it is because of this patented element. This
mm-hmm.
charges from the top and the bottom simultaneously.
Oh, I see. Can you, without divulging any secrets, can you give us a little précis of how that works?
Well, in other words, the present battery charges from the top alone,
mm-hmm.
so that wears out the plates.
Mm-hmm.
That takes longer to charge.
Mm-hmm.
When you charge it from three standpoints, you reduce the wear on the plates, you reduce the time of charge,
mm-hmm.
and you reduce the weight of the battery, you reduce the time it lasts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you lengthen the time it lasts.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those elements are overcome by this patented battery.
Mm-hmm.
The other elements that I mentioned before were, you know, the controllers and the engine, the motor itself.
Right.
And the various elements that overcome limited battery function,
mm-hmm.
like heat and cold,
yes.
and gas and watering. So these elements, plus the auxiliary power unit, do a great service to the electric car and make it actually operate along with our power brakes and power steering and automatic transmission and regenerative braking,
mm-hmm.
Make it operate like an ordinary car. You can get out of a Cadillac and get into this car and drive off, and you don't have to relearn anything.
Mm-hmm. To my uninitiated ears, could you tell me exactly how you create a propulsion with an electric charge? How is that accomplished?
Well, you have a battery,
mm-hmm.
that supplies the power,
right.
to a motor. And the motor drives a drive shaft just like an engine drives a drive shaft.
I see.
And the rest of it is just like a regular automobile. It has a transmission. It has an axle. It has everything. The difference is you replace an engine with a motor.
With an electric motor.
Electric motor, yes.
Of 150 volts.
Yes.
Right. And that, of course, provides the propulsive charge, which drives the, various...
And it has an automatic shift so
mm-hmm.
that you're accustomed to the way it drives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the only thing is that when you stop, everything stops. You're not using any gas or any
uh-huh.
juice.
Uh-huh. And you're
so it's pretty good in traffic from that standpoint.
And the regenerative brake principle, where'd you come up with that?
Well, that is a reverse cycle. In other words, when you have been accelerating and now you are decelerating,
mm-hmm.
so it reverses the juice. In other words, it now charges the battery instead of taking energy from the battery.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing happens automatically when you're going downhill.
Mm-hmm.
It's an automatic arrangement that accomplishes that, which is kind of an easy way to explain it.
Well, it's certainly fascinating. The the you have something called the pulse control by high power electronic chopper SCR. What does that mean?
Well, that allows you to increase your power. For instance, an automatic gear shift, you see, you're shifting from a low gear to a high gear, and this allows the electric motor to accomplish that without burning it out.
Mm.
And that's what the chopper is for. And, you know, I'm putting it in sort of ordinary language, but that's not exactly it.
That's right, yes. And you have a, you said you had batteries placed in the front and the rear.
Yes.
But you have a main, battery of 150 volts.
Well, that's the main battery.
The battery complex.
Yes.
It's
that's
broken
right.
up into several units. Huh?
And then there's a small 12-volt battery, too, to run the horn and, you know, various auxiliary things. Yes.
Auxiliary things.
Yes.
I see there's a special battery for that. But one of the the neat features that I see is that you have onboard chargers that are working
well,
while you're using the battery or while it's standing still?
No, the onboard charger is the charger that you use when you plug it in at home.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's for auxiliary charging.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you do have a certain amount of charging even while you're standing still, don't you?
At first we use the auxiliary engine as a battery charger,
mm-hmm.
but then we found it more advantageous to use it in tandem with the motor, so that, for instance, if you know that you're going further than you expected or than you planned,
mm-hmm.
or than the battery alone would take you, you turn that on and use it simultaneously so that you don't use as much juice from the battery.
Mm-hmm.
Or in an emergency, the same thing.
How would your onboard generator work? How would that
Well, I just said that the onboard, the generator,
the
charger.
Yeah, the generator.
Well, it works the same as a regular generator.
Mm-hmm. It takes that function.
Yes.
You're projecting what kind of performance for the Silver Bolt in terms of mileage and range?
Well,
in this case, range. Yes.
With the auxiliary power unit, you can get about 200 miles, or, you know, depending on how you drive it.
Before recharging.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It certainly extends the old electrics. We're lucky to get 50 miles.
That's right.
But
the thing is that you can do this at highway speeds.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, for instance, Detroit Edison down here is testing the GM electric van.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want you to get 30 miles away from the charge station.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Will the utilities companies, do you think, cooperate in allowing you to somehow use their facilities? Or?
Well, you see, when we have completed the prototype and gone into limited production,
mm-hmm.
on the cars and the vans, we expect the utility companies to be a prime customer,
mm-hmm.
of both,
right.
Not just as an advertising gimmick, but to develop the market itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we also expect rent-a-car companies to be interested.
Oh, very much so. But it seems to me the big stumbling block will be the number of charging stations you'll have to erect.
Well, that's no problem. We can produce those easily.
Very easy to produce.
Yes.
You've indicated that your speed is quite generous and that your acceleration is quite good.
Yes.
And what is the range largely? Somewhere between 70 and 80 miles an hour, did you say?
75 miles an hour,
yes. Yeah. And your acceleration in something like what?
Well, I believe it's, of course that has changed too recently. I think 0 to 50 in about 10 seconds.
You you talk here on this spec sheet of a possibility of a 10 kilowatt generator to be powered by a rotary gasoline engine.
Well, you see, that was the original plan. See, the generator charged the battery,
mm-hmm.
but now we do it in tandem with the motor.
The whole project of the Silver Bolt is quite a visionary futuristic concept.
It is, and we plan to, you know, go much further than where we are now.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I've been working on this for about about 12 years now,
mm-hmm.
and Mr. Aronson has been working on it for about 17, I guess,
mm-hmm.
maybe 18. So that it's not a passing fancy; it's a well thought out and successfully plan. The thing is that there are no other people who have lasted this long. Other people have tried to make electric cars and dropped out, and
mm-hmm.
Vans too. I understand GM has just canceled their Bedford van in England.
Really?
Yeah.
You mentioned, of course, the proliferation of golf carts earlier on. Were they an early type of electric car vehicle?
Yes, they are still.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we have plans for that as well.
Good.
And as a matter of fact, in the Bahamas, where we will be making the propulsion system, we are going to make streetable electric golf carts, in other words, with headlights and bumpers and so forth, because the islands, you see, are only about 30 miles long, and they don't have any gas, and they don't have any oil supplies. So that should be a popular thing in the Caribbean.
There's a great market in the Caribbean, as I understand, for small-scale transportation for tourists touring the islands.
Yes, and that's what we're talking about too.
Mm-hmm.
Thing is that, you know, no sense in having a Lincoln limousine there.
No,
you just go 3 miles to the store or to the restaurant or whatever.
How's your financing arrangements generally, without revealing any of your sources? How are they working out?
Well, we're building the battery plant, as I said, in the Bahamas. We're about to begin it. And we have some private investors and also the World Bank, which is going to finance 60% of it.
You perceive probably a world market here, perhaps even more a world market than a domestic market, don't you?
No, I think the U.S. will be the main market, but there is a possibility for a world market. The Koreans and the Japanese and the Chinese are all interested.
The small third world countries.
Yeah, we're in a matter of fact right now negotiating with the Chinese. They want us to build a battery plant in Shanghai.
And that would be the prelude to a production of the Silver Bolt there as well.
Well, I don't know about that at the time. They have an antiquated battery plant. So,
oh, do they?
Yes, but the South Koreans are interested in the electric car. And the Japanese, I understand, are developing one, but we're going to beat them.
Think you're going to consider anything like a co-production with a Korean?
That's
Korean
a possibility.
Complex,
yes,
yeah.
Might even with a Korean car.
The Korean car. Well, it seems like this probably is a sort of a culmination of a decade or several decades of creative activity on your part. You've come down to a practical solution to the internal.
Well, it is, and. The thing is about the Silver Bolt concept is it's a culmination not only of a lifetime of design, because this car, to me, represents the present acme of design,
mm-hmm.
along with the tops in propulsion concept.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing sort of comes together with a product that is a class product as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have an interior that's as good as a Rolls Royce.
Yes. So you haven't left your interiors behind. They're not the...
No, no.
They're not
We've
the,
got a leather padded instrument panel.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful.
And you'll have options, of course.
Well, they're all the options are included.
Oh, they'd be standard equipment?
Yes.
And any other innovations, interior innovations on this model that you tell us about?
Well, the main innovations are, for instance, the instrument that tells you it's a first, gives you the charge quality of the battery.
Right.
So that you know exactly all the time the condition of the battery, and you never get stuck anywhere.
Right. It's not an idiot light that comes on and tells you at the last minute.
No, no.
Running out. Well, this seemed to me would be sort of a, although you're far from retired or far from ending your career, this is a marvelous step forward in a long career of innovative design.
I think so, and the thing is that I think this really is a car of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because, whether one pays only 80 cents a gallon today for gasoline, you know it's not going to last.
Mm-hmm.
The gasoline supplies are finite, and whether, you know, I'm around when the time comes, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm planning on it.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Henry Lowe. Very, very enlightening.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. In terms of the future, how do you see it?
Well, what I believe is that man's ingenuity is limitless, and what man can think of can be accomplished. Always has been, and I believe it is happening now.
You see that as a culmination of your research as well?
Oh, yes. I believe that electric power is coming from space in the future, microwave to Earth.
And how far in the future is that?
I think one could do it now if one devoted the proper energy to it.
Good. Thank you very much.